Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 261, Zulu War, Ntombi River Massacre and Prince Hamu's Defection. Just a quick note, 261 is a significant number. It was the bib number worn by Catherine Switzer during the 1967 Boston Marathon, where she became the first woman to officially finish the race, fighting off an overzealous official who tried to rip her bib off on the way. But for the readers of a weekly illustrated and highly influential newspaper called The Graphic in London, it was the illustration At Bay, the Battle of San Luana, which appeared on page 261, that struck home. This specific image showed the final stand of the 24th Regiment and was the very first visual representation that brought the carnage of the Zulu War into the living rooms of the British public. It was the moment the myth of the war was born, right on page 261. Fresh disasters awaited Lord Chelmsford back in Zululand. Colonel Rowland's No. 5 column had been sent to guard the roads and garrison the Boer towns in the northeastern Transvaal, policing the Zulu across the border, but also to overawe the more volatile Boers who wanted to take advantage of the war in Zululand by rebelling against British rule. The German village of Lüneburg was vulnerable within striking distance of Imbilini, who was Cetshwayo's loose cannon along the Pongola River, and Manyanyoba, who hailed from the Ntombi Valley. Although Manyanyoba had seemed prepared to open negotiations with the British, he was overborne by his chief Ndunas, who wanted war. Once convinced he should support King Cetshwayo's call for war, Manyanyoba led a powerful force to join Imbilini and Xolisi Nduna Tolaka Dilikana, who had made his way east from Hlobane. Their target was the 1,500 or so Christianized black workers, the Amakholwa of the Ntombi Valley. They attacked and killed 41 Amakholwa, burned their homes down and drove off hundreds of cattle. The farm owners had already gone into Lüneburg and left their workers exposed. In a simple twist of fate, many of the Wakkerstroom Boers who owned farms in this region had entered a secret pact with the Zulu. The Boers were operating as guides for the attacking impi in exchange for their property being spared. In retaliation, British troops were sent to garrison Lüneburg and four companies of the 80th Regiment were dispatched there under Major Charles Tucker. Redvers Buller joined them from Kambula further west, leading a force of 54 mounted men and 517 black auxiliaries against Manyanyoba's caves. 34 Zulu warriors were killed, 5 imizi burned down, and 375 head of cattle, 250 goats, and 8 sheep captured for the loss of 2 black auxiliaries. But Manyanyoba remained at large, his main force unaffected. All of the fighting in this region caused the Zulu between Lüneburg and Derby to abandon their fields for the security of their Ngungama Mountains, close to the broken terrain of the Pongola and Bavani rivers. The British attacked a Zulu stronghold at Talaku Mountain inside the Swazi zone, inflicting casualties, but failing to take the mountain itself. The same story was repeated on the 20th of February when a British patrol from Lüneburg attacked Makatiskop Mountain, and again on the 25th, but they failed to dislodge Manyanyoba. The British were beginning to realize there would be no easy result in this area. Of all the British battalions in South Africa, the 80th had the longest experience on the Zulu frontier. 300 men had been stationed at Utrecht from 1876 and were involved in the campaign against Amahlubi chief Sekukuni. 4 companies were based close to Evelyn Wood's entrenchment at Kambula and were technically under his command. Late in February 1879, a convoy of 18 wagons loaded with ammunition, flour and mealies left Lydenburg to supply the garrison. At first things went well, but when they arrived at the border with Zululand, their route was less secure, particularly as they approached the Ntombi River, because Imbilini was operating close by. Tucker sent a company of the 80th to escort the wagon from Derby, but heavy rainfall had swelled the rivers and softened the ground. By March 8th, the convoy was still 16 kilometers away from Lüneburg. Fearing an attack, Tucker sent a message to the company commander to get into Lüneburg that night at any cost. But the officer in command of the convoy took the message literally and abandoned his wagons. He reached the lager at Lüneburg at 10 p.m., while a small escort left behind managed to get 6 wagons as far as the Ntombi River. That was a scant 6 kilometers from Lüneburg, but the lead wagon was now stuck halfway across the drift, trapping the others behind it. 6 more wagons were even further back, 5 kilometers on the far side of the drift, and these carried the all-important ammunition. On the 9th, Tucker sent a party to recover the ammunition wagons, but by now the 40-meter-wide Ntombi River had burst its banks from the heavy rainfall. The drift was unusable. The British spent the whole wet day unloading the lead wagon and managing to pull it clear. The 6 other wagons managed to make it to Lüneburg Lager, which lay to the southwest. On the 9th, 100 men under Captain David Moriarty were dispatched with a wagon loaded with beams to make a raft to get across to the far side. Their orders: retrieve the ammunition wagons, wait on the other side of the river until it went down, then hurry across to Lüneburg. Moriarty was a 42-year-old experienced officer who had fought against Sekhukhune and had served on the Zulu border for 3 years. By the evening of the 9th, he had managed to bring all the ammunition wagons to the far side of the Ntombi, but the river was still in spate and too deep to ford. The British were now riding their luck, and that lady was about to run out. The Zulu were monitoring all this movement, and Imbilini realized his relatively large Amabutho was powerful enough to smash the small company of British soldiers. The problem he had was their lager, and the British were going to make his problem go away to some extent, because Moriarty had messed up his defenses. He had split the company in two. A minority of 35 men were camped on the Lüneburg side, while 70 others were on the opposite bank with the wagon lager. In an extreme act of daring, on the evening of the 11th, Imbilini himself walked into this unsuspecting lager calmly chewing on a mealie to spy out the British positions. They didn't seem to realize. He would have seen what Colonel Tucker saw later. He rode up to investigate and was less than impressed. Moriarty's lager was an inverted V shape, not the preferred oval or circle. He'd used the flooding river as his open base of the V, with the line of the wagons coming to a point away from the water. But the water level began to drop, which meant that the base of the lager was now short of the river. Moriarty had also skimped on the wagons. He did not use the poles of the wagon to run under each other, but tied the poles to the back of the wagon ahead. This was a weak point on each of the wagons. There was a low gap between these vehicles that was 3 feet high, no protection at all against Zulus attacking in numbers. Tucker saw it was almost dark, not much could be done. Furthermore, 2 of the ammunition wagons were now inside the lager, surrounded by 250 oxen. How Moriarty was planning to get to his ammunition past these massive beasts during an attack was a bit of a mystery. Tucker tisked, and then rode back to Lüneburg, hoping upon hope that the Zulu were far away. Later, Moriarty's subaltern, Lieutenant Henry Harwood, arrived at dusk. He'd spent all day searching for lost cattle and was exhausted. Harwood slept for an hour or two, then was ordered by Moriarty to cross to the Lüneburg side to take command of the 35 men there. This saved his life, but as you're going to hear, not his reputation. 2 sentries were posted outside the lager near Moriarty's tent, but they could only see about 50 meters away because there was a slope to their front, further weakening the defense. On the other side, a single sentry was posted, and he was on higher ground. Had the night been clear, he would have had a panoramic view of the lager. But he didn't, because the night was wet and misty. At 3:30 a.m. on the morning of the 12th of March, a shot was heard near the camp. The British, on both sides of the river, turned out. Instead of investigating, Moriarty decided it was nothing. You know, gunshots just go off in the middle of the night, so far away from your camp, no worries. They all went back to sleep, except for the sentries. And the sentry on the far side, at about 5 a.m., as the light began improving, as the mist cleared slightly, realized to his horror that there was a huge Zulu army advancing in complete silence. They had extended their front across the whole valley, there were so many. The sentry fired a warning shot, followed by the sentries near Moriarty's tent. Before the British had time to get to their positions, the Zulu warriors had already fired their volley, thrown down their guns, and were around the wagons and through the feeble defences. It was almost instant carnage. The battle began with hand-to-hand combat. Moriarty didn't go down easily. He rushed out of his tent with his revolver and had an assegai driven through his back. Still, he staggered onwards, trying to climb a disselboom, the pole at the front of the wagon to which oxen were tied. When he was shot by a warrior, he fell to his knees and shouted, "I am done! Fire away, boys!" But his boys couldn't get a single shot off. Survivors were fleeing towards the Ntombi River, while the small detachment on the other side provided covering fire. They couldn't stop this carnage. In a few minutes, most of the 70 British troops were dead. And now 200 warriors had swum across the river and were attacking the small detachment. Lieutenant Henry Harwood ordered his men to retire, and in Harwood's case he made sure of that, galloping off, leaving his men to face the Zulu while he charged off in terror. Colour Sergeant Anthony Booth was left behind and was too discreet in his official report later to mention this brazen act of cowardice. The survivors fired a volley, retreated, fired another volley. This went on for 5 kilometres, and when 4 men split from this group, they were all killed. At Rabi's farm, 3.5 kilometres from Lunenburg, the Zulu warriors finally gave up the chase. Booth, by the way, received a Victoria Cross for his leadership, and the citation reads, "Had it not been for the coolness displayed by this NCO, not one man would have escaped." Meanwhile, Harwood's craven ride ended at Lunenburg, where he made straight for Tucker's tent, in a panic, shouting, "Major! Major!" and fell to his knees. "The picture of death," as Tucker wrote later. "The camp is in the hands of the enemy. They are all slaughtered, and I've galloped in for my life." Then Harwood fell on Tucker's bed in a dead faint. Tucker ordered all available horses to be saddled, and 150 men to follow on foot. They galloped back to the Ntombi Drift, where a scene of chaos was observed. His men were lying all over the place, some naked, others half-clad, bodies full of assegai wounds. Nearly all were disemboweled. Tucker shouted that help was at hand, and by some miracle, 3 men emerged from the river, a British soldier and 2 African drivers. The British soldier threw himself into the Ntombi, but he couldn't swim, and was carried downstream. He managed to grab hold of the far bank and haul himself out straight into the view of a Zulu warrior who tried to stab him. The soldier grabbed the blade, killed his assailant, then slipped back into the water and hid his head under grass. The 2 African drivers were also close by, all 3 saved by Tucker's intervention. The 75 dead were buried in a long trench, except for Moriarty, whose body, along with a Dr. Cobbin, were brought back to Lunenburg and buried there. Fewer than 1,000 Zulu warriors had been involved, followers of Imbilini and Manyanyoba, as well as some Abakolusi and even a few members of the Royal Amabutu who'd fought at Isandlwana. Imbilini returned to his homestead on Tlobani Mountain with his captured rifles, his ammunition, horses, cattle, well satisfied. Zulu lost 30 men in the Battle of Ntombi River. Another disaster for Chelmsford to relay to London, and one caused by poor planning once again. Moriarty was dead, so someone else had to take the blame. The obvious scapegoat was Harwood. He was all excuses. "I endeavoured to rally my men," he lied. "But they were too scattered, and finding my reformation impossible, I mounted my horse and galloped into Lunenburg at utmost speed." He had panicked and left his men for dead. Chelmsford described his report as a very shady account of his own proceedings in riding away to Lunenburg at full speed and leaving his men to their fate. He should have, of course, in British officer tradition, stuck with his men to the end, chin up, steely-eyed, into the sticky maw of fate, etc., etc. Chelmsford at first took no action. He made no example of Harwood. That would only happen the following year, when Wolseley had replaced Chelmsford. Harwood had returned to England by then, but he was shipped back to South Africa and court-martialed. The court, however, accepted Harwood's defence that arrangements at the camp were Moriarty's fault, and that he'd run away because he couldn't exercise his authority. Wolseley refused to confirm the verdict, highly unusual. Harwood did return to duty, but his career was over. Later, in 1880, he resigned his commission, the stamp of coward, forever tainting his name. Back in Zululand, after the Battle of Ntombi River, the stunned garrison at Lunenburg expected an imminent attack, but just as with Asantlwan, the Zulu failed to follow up on a major victory. Perhaps they would focus on Colonel Wood's camp at Kambula. The Zulu remained inactive, though, through the rest of March. And now the British began to raid. On the late day in March, they mounted a patrol from Kambula and ravaged the Namizi and Mili fields in the Ntombi Valley as payback to Manyanyoba's adherents. This time there was no resistance. The British did not know that Cetshwayo had issued new orders. After the terrible casualties his forces had taken at Rorke's Drift and at Santlwana, he forbade his army from attacking any entrenched British position. That was wise, given British firepower, but it also meant he was handing the initiative to his enemy. Down on the coast, in Ishowe, the fact that a British force was besieged inside his own territory irritated Cetshwayo, preferring to blockade them than full frontal attack. The fort was cut off from supplies. About 500 warriors surrounded the British there, and small parties of 40 or 50 at a time harried the defenders. Cetshwayo's hot-headed son, Dabulumanzi, lived nearby at Untumeni, alongside Mabumwingwana, but neither wanted to test the British at the fort with a direct assault. Inside the fort, Lieutenant Colonel Pearson was playing the long game. To break the terrible monotony inside, he decided to attack Isikwakeni, the Ikanda near Ntumeni, and Bulumanzi's home. A force of 450 men and a 7-pound gun left on the morning of the 1st of March, but the Zulu detected their approach and streamed to safety before the British arrived at dawn. After burning the Ikanda, Pearson withdrew, having failed to torch Bulumanzi's own Umuzi, and the Zulu Induna now counterattacked, riding on a black horse. He was easily identifiable, leading his 500 men as they pursued Pearson's men back to the safety of the fort. Pearson wrote later that had the Zulu not been such inaccurate shots, his retreat could have ended in disaster. On the 11th and 12th of March, as the Battle of Ntombi River raged, a large Zulu army was spotted moving towards the Tugela River on the coast. The men inside Ishowe realized a relief force may be on its way. However, on the 13th, the garrison was informed by a messenger that the relief force would only arrive in April. Pearson was amazed to see the Zulu army march back 2 days later. They had received the same intelligence. Cetshwayo had heard about Shepstone's second planned invasion. It was imminent. He was also angered by Pearson's presence in his midst and by Wood's ability to conduct his own form of mobile warfare against the Zulu in the north. But what really got his goat was Prince Hamu, who had finally defected to the British in early March. Cetshwayo was gathering his other chiefs and princes to test their loyalty. Hamu's defection was a fact that was only whispered at Undini, so significant was his act. Some were saying, sotto voce, of course, that this portended the breakup of the Zulu kingdom. Cetshwayo knew that important rule, keep your friends close but your enemies closer. At the outbreak of war, he had ordered Hamu to Ondini, where he could keep the vacillating chief under close scrutiny. But Hamu managed to communicate with his chief Isunduna, both Ngwengwana and Unyumbana, back in his district, and they exchanged secret messages with Colonel Wood in turn. Hamu treated with the Swazi king for sanctuary should he flee Zululand. Throughout February, he quarreled openly with Cetshwayo about who caused the war. Finally, the troublesome chief managed to slip away from Undini in March. Cetshwayo at first tried to butter him up, sending him a gift of cattle to return, but he refused. It had taken this act of rebellion for Cetshwayo to finally send an impi to capture Hamu and bring him back for swift justice. Instead, the impi killed a few of his followers, but failed in their main task. Hamu got away. He crossed the Pongola River into Swaziland on the 10th of March, and, joined by his wives, he was escorted by a British patrol to Kambula. Over the next few days, more than 1,300 of his followers joined him, and his warriors ended up drafted into Wood's irregulars, while Hamu and his wives were sent to Utrecht and safety. The Zulu king now ordered his full army to gather at Undini by the new moon on the 22nd of March to be ritually prepared for war once more. Cetshwayo was back in war mode, but he had been inactive for 2 months and the British were getting their mojo back. This did not bode well for the Zulu king. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog where I'm loading updates about various episodes. You can sign up for a little newsletter there. Until next, Salagatli.